Thank you for tuning in. This is episode 5 of the Mbali Nwako podcast. And today I'm joined by a very special guest, Wendy Geza. And if I may add, she's an amazing human being if you get to meet her in person. Wendy's a research assistant and a project facilitator at the University of KwaZulu-Natal and is also involved in looking after two community projects, one being the Sustainable Healthy Food Systems Project and the other being the Umngeni Resilience Project. Furthermore, Wendy is pursuing her PhD in food security at the University of KwaZulu-Natal. Now, the reason why I wanted to have a conversation with Wendy is because she has firsthand real-life experience working with rural small-scale farmers on the ground. And that experience alone is gold. Why I say this is because I find that there is so much interest and focus today around small-scale rural farmers and how they view things like climate change, agri-tech, food security, unemployment, and how they're able to sustain their communities by growing their own food. And so you can thank me later because Wendy shares valuable insights regarding all of the above. So without further ado, I present to you Wendy Geza. My name is Mbali Nwako, and welcome to the Mbali Nwako podcast. I'm a farmer, and I created this podcast to discuss all things agriculture. I will be interviewing and having in-depth conversations with industry experts such as farmers, scientists, agronomists, agri-tech specialists, to policymakers and investors. Basically, anyone you can think of in agriculture and across its value chain. So let's dive right into today's episode. Hi, Wendy. How are you doing?
I'm good, thanks, Bali. And how are you today?
I'm doing good. It's been a while since we caught up. How have you been?
No, I've been good. I've been busy here and there, but I've been good. And I hope that you're keeping well on your side.
Thank you. I'm doing well, thanks. Thanks for asking. Well, I'm so excited for this conversation because you are one of the first persons or very few individuals that I know that has firsthand experience dealing or working with small-scale rural farmers on the ground. So how long have you been in this role and what has that experience been like for you?
Well, it's been very eye-opening for me, and my main lessons have been the importance of exposure in rural communities and also access to information. I started volunteering for the Farmer Support Group, which is an organization within UKZN in 2016. Mm-hmm. And I was doing that as part of my research module. And then from there on, I worked for the Agribusiness Development Agency in 2017, which is a unit of the Department of Agriculture. And then throughout my postgrad studies, I've been working in various projects that work with rural communities and also projects that mainly focus on assisting small-scale farmers, such as the Umngeni Resilience Projects and the Sustainable Healthy Food Systems Projects. So I've been working in most rural communities throughout KZN, building resilience to climate change and helping to build farmer capacity, offering a variety of trainings from basic production planning, value adding, bookkeeping, and also doing a number of field trips with the farmers, exposing them to different parts of the value chain. So it's been quite exciting for me as well.
What have you learned? From working with the small scale farmers, because you mentioned certain things like climate change, giving them like business skills, training and support, exposing them to the entire agricultural value chain. When you started interacting and working with these small scale farmers, what experience had they been exposed to prior to you bringing all these additional value adds?
Most of the farmers in rural communities, they understand farming based on, if you look at agriculture right now and the way that your grandparents and your parents were farming, most people in rural communities still have that idea of agriculture. So most of the systems that they use and the methods that they use to farm are still coming from a very conventional perspective. So most of them know how to plant, but when you think about climate change and also how things have changed over the years, when you're looking at technology and other advancements that have happened, most people can't then translate that to what they already know. So you find that, for instance, if you'd ask somebody directly in a rural community, oh, have you heard about climate change, or do you know what climate change is? They'd respond saying that, yes, I've heard about it. I've heard about it on radio. And I know that it's something that's happening in Johannesburg or it's happening in Durban, but they can't related to what's happening in front of them. So that's when you then try to contextualize what you're trying to either teach them, or the knowledge that you're trying to make them aware of, that listen, if you haven't heard about climate change, have you actually noticed any differences in the yields over the years? Have you noticed any new pests or diseases around? Have you, you know? So it's just a matter of contextualizing things. They're very quite knowledgeable on a lot that's happening in farming, but they can't they find it very difficult to look at farming as a business. Most of them think of farming as something that you have to do in order to feed your family. And then if you do have surplus produce, then you sell it to make additional income. But they never think of it in a business context.
And why do you think they started farming? Because if they didn't think of it from a business context, and you're saying most of them are farming for their immediate consumption, is it the result of them going into farming? Was it because of lack of food, or, you know, trying to raise a bit of money here and there because of high unemployment rates? Why do you think they decided to choose producing food instead of doing other small activities that could help their livelihoods?
I think it's a little bit of both. Some people are mainly farming to feed their families, especially because you find that in rural communities, there's quite a high unemployment rate. So most people who didn't get a chance to go to school are able to feed their families. Like some of the community members that we work in, especially the older groups, they are able to sell off chilies or other vegetables, and they sell in order to pay for registration fees for their children. So it really depends. And some of them start farming because they see from their neighbors that, oh, actually these guys are making money out of this. And then they start trying to farm in order to sell to the neighboring school or somebody who's in charge of the feeding scheme at those schools, or to sell to people who cook at the ranks, etc. So it's a little bit of both.
So how do you firstly identify these farmers, and what type of size in terms of land are they producing on average?
It's very different in a sense that some like organizations that I've worked for, farmers would come to the organization seeking assistance, and they go through an application process and then they get selected. And then with others, organizations that I've worked for, like for example the university, you'd find that a certain municipality of that area was implementing a project, or they've got funding to do a project to assist rural community members, but they don't have the expertise. So then they go to the university to outsource the university in order to assist that particular community. So it depends. Some communities are pre-selected because of whatever government strategy is being implemented, whereas others are coming into the organization to apply in order to seek assistance. So it's very different. And you'd find because of that, then you get different cases where you have individual farmers working as cooperatives, and also other groups that are scattered, and then you bring them together. It mainly depends on the dynamics. So in terms of land sizes, it could be anything from 5 hectares to about 65, depending on the situation.
Okay. And the demographic of these small-scale farmers that you're providing support to, is it mostly young individuals, women, male? What's the demographic?
At the moment, I'm working with mainly youth groups. But in the past, like I said, it depends on the organization that you're working for. But you get a little bit of everyone. Sometimes you find cooperatives that have a mixture of young people, older people. But it's usually mostly females in the groups, because a lot of the food production activities in rural communities are still mainly reliant on the females. So in most of the groups, even if it's a mix of males and females, older and younger, you still find that majority of them is females.
So, you know, in farming, we talk a lot about challenges that farmers face and experience, whether it's commercial farmers or mid-scale farmers or small-scale farmers, smallholders, whichever term you prefer to define all these farmers. But what have been the challenges that you have experienced on the ground dealing with these or working with the small-scale farmers?
It's mainly, I'd say it's access to basic information about farming. Like I'd mentioned, like it's the simplest thing in terms of information. Most of them don't know how to access market, where to actually find the markets. And they never think beyond primary production. They never think about things such as value adding, and they never are able to link how economic trends could impact their farming activities. They don't know how to access opportunities or where to actually go. And a lot of them need training. And most of them also need more capacity in terms of responding to threats in agriculture as a whole. So, for example, if you look at the water availability challenges that we're currently having as a country and the change in weather patterns, and also if you're looking at the supply of electricity. Now, if you are a farmer in the rural communities and you can see that, or you've noticed that your soil fertility is starting to decline over the years, you'd find that most of them are unable to buy fertilizer. So even the little challenges that you as a commercial farmer would experience, for them, the challenges are more intensified because of their limited capacity to respond to those challenges. Because most of them, like I said, you'd find that the soil fertility is declining, but they don't have finances to purchase fertilizer. And somebody can see that, you know, the weather patterns are changing. It's not raining as much as it used to, but they can't afford to put up irrigation pumps or to have a borehole and that sort of thing. So most of the challenges that are facing everyone in general, for them, it's more intensified.
Yeah. And so what do you do as a consultant or as an agricultural extension officer when you find these challenges? You mentioned things like fertilizers, inability to have water to obviously, I think, irrigate their crops. So, yeah, are you seeking additional partners, partnerships? Like maybe have you explored the opportunity to maybe start engaging with seedling companies or seed companies, chemical companies, irrigation companies that could maybe donate irrigation? Because vastly, you did say that a number of these small-scale farmers don't have those finances. And then in addition to that, are you trying to help them to become bankable? You mentioned earlier that they do not treat their farming activities as a business, but mostly for home consumption. So have you tried those interventions to actually make them bankable, open business bank accounts, so that whatever revenue that they get from selling from immediate neighbors, etc., they're able to bank that money and then slowly start paying off expenses directly in relation to their operations?
Yes, we do. But like I said, most of the interventions that we do come up with are usually based on the particular context in that community. So we do work with other companies such as your seedling companies and companies that are installing irrigation. But when we do such, we try to ensure that, like, for instance, we are installing an irrigation system in one of the communities, but we had wanted to ensure that when we are installing it and when this actual system is being built, all community members are present so that they can see how the pipes are being connected and how everything is being set up. Because the most important thing when it comes to providing assistance in rural communities is to ensure that after the project has left, or after you as the funder have left, the people in the community are still able to understand how to maintain the systems and how to operate and what to do in case anything goes wrong. Because it's not all the time that they'd be able to call you to come back that, oh, we've got a burst pipe or we've got this. You need to also give them that training for them to be able to know what to do once you've left. And we try to also work with other companies. Like for instance, sometimes we have students like myself in the university who are doing a particular research. So you're able to come to the community. Let's say, for example, you're doing a soybean trial or you're planting something. So you come to the community and you ask them to give you that piece of land, but then through that process, you're able to teach them more about the crop that you're actually going to be planting there, and they're able to help you throughout everything while you're harvesting, if you're weeding, whatever. So by the time that you leave and you graduate with your degree, the community is now aware of what soybean is, what markets are there for soybean, and how do you actually cultivate it and all of that. So we tried different approaches to ensure that they have access to information and also resources.
Yeah, I really, really commend you for the work that you're doing, because I know it's not easy dealing with rural communities, because there's so many social dynamics that really threaten the longevity of such projects. So just on average, like, how long do these projects last for? Is it a 12-month program, a project, 2 years, 3 years? And the reason why I ask that is because, like, you know, I've had conversations previously with professionals in corporate SA who also have desires of coming up with CSI project or enterprise supply development projects to assist rural communities. But then you find that in most of these conversations, there's a general trend where people say, yeah, we've invested so much money in rural community X, where we've tried to assist maybe 50 farmers for about 2 years. And then we've implemented, like, we've implemented different food programs. We've bought them seeds. We've bought them irrigation. We've bought them JoJo tanks. We've put fencing on the land that they're producing on. We've provided additional extension resource services with the partners that we work with. So the list is quite endless. And what you almost always hear at the end of that is that, oh, but when we leave the project or exit the project and we think that these communities are then able to sustain themselves going forward, 6 months down the line, when you visit in terms of what has happened, how have they been keeping up, you find that a lot of the infrastructure now is now in vandalized cooperatives as well. You find that in a cooperatives is like more than 10 people. When you come back and you investigate, maybe you started the project with 10 people in that specific cooperative. Then try and engage with them further a few months down the line, you find that maybe there's only like 3 members left. So there's so many dynamics. And sometimes you find that people in the communities have then just abandoned that project because maybe there was an opportunity that they found at a nearby office or department, or found additional employment. So have you also experienced those type of things with the work that you do amongst these rural communities?
Yes, definitely, definitely. I think just even thinking about community dynamics, you do find those groups that are like, you'd come in, or maybe they approach the organization, they want assistance, you come in and you try and first gauge what it, because I think the most important thing is, firstly, in the beginning stages, it's important for you to identify what it is that the people want to do. Because I could be sitting in my office and thinking, oh, wouldn't it be nice if we had to start a youth group that does this and this and this. And then I get there and I find out that the guys have a completely different idea from what I was thinking. So it's very, very important that when you're coming into these communities, you first identify what are their goals, what are they hoping to achieve, where are they, and what do they think they need in order to move from point A to point B. So that's when then you get to tailor make the trainings that you need to do, and also try and organize the support that you're going to be providing to them. Because I've noticed that over time, if you follow, or if you try and assist them to reach their dreams, it's most likely going to be sustainable after you have left, because it's what they initially wanted to do. Yeah. And it's what they were interested in. So it's nothing that was imposed externally. So that's very important if you want projects to last. And in terms of community dynamics, that's something that we cannot prevent, because you'd find that it's like petty community dynamics, in a sense that you'd find that a particular neighbor is not getting along with another one because their grandparents used to fight for a piece of land, and then now this happened. So those are things that you can't ignore, but at the same time, it's things that don't necessarily affect you. So it's also quite important to then make the group sit down together and make them form a code of conduct, so they're able to address each other and they know how to deal with personal issues versus group issues that are occurring because of what's bringing us together, which is farming. And you do get those groups where they only heard that there's a particular project that's going to come and do this and this, and they might have heard that, okay, the project might give them seed. So in the beginning, you always get large amounts of people coming in, large numbers. And then as the project carries on, you're able to sift those people who are not as serious and they were just coming in because they thought they were going to get something out quickly. So those people do eventually just leave because they realize that it's taking longer than they thought. And it's not a matter of you coming in and getting seed and going. There's a lot of learning that's involved. There's a lot of commitment from your side and things that you need to do to ensure that you're learning and, you know, you're just engaging in the project as well. So I have had people in the past who were just starting, especially with young people. I've had a group that I used to work with. And in the beginning, we had about 25 members. And after 3 months of working with them and trying to get them into farming and doing various field trips that they had asked for in order to increase their exposure and to let them see these things that they're hoping to become in the future and visiting farmers who are also young, I realized that there was a post for, I think it was training police officers or something that came out and it wanted young people between the ages of, I think it was 24 to 35 or something. And at that time, I lost about 10 of them because they all applied and they left. So it does happen. It does.
And how does that then affect your relationship with particular stakeholders? Because I can imagine you would have approached a seed company to say, I'm assisting and helping community X with this type of project and we need these certain interventions from you, and maybe you sell the dream that, you know, these are youth, so you're helping in youth participation, growth, influencing them to really seek agriculture as a career of choice, and then things like this happen where now you go back to your sponsor or stakeholder and say, unfortunately, we've lost youth to other career opportunities. How does that then affect the relationship between yourself and the stakeholders, even for future projects?
It definitely does affect it in a negative way. But luckily on our side, we've been using, when it comes to the youth projects, we've been using stakeholders that have been working with us with projects that involved older people. So they tend to be very aware of the various community dynamics. So it's much easier when such things do happen. And in the past, you'd find that, like, I would lose 10, and then after 8 months or so, another 9 or 7 is going to come in and they just, you know, they're interested in what we're doing, or they see us gathering and they're like, oh, okay, I just wanted to, you know, because you guys have been gathering here for 8 months, I've been wondering what's going on, can I come through and listen? And we're like, oh, so you do lose and gain people. But yeah. I think it's quite important for you to have stakeholders that are also very aware of the various project dynamics, so that when such things happen, it doesn't necessarily affect the support that they're giving out to the community.
Yeah. So what's the general perception of youth in rural areas regarding agriculture?
The general perception that other people have about youth is that young people are not interested in agriculture, and, you know, they want to work in the corporate world, and, you know, they want to drive nice cars, etc., etc. And from what I have experienced working with young people, there are young people that are interested in agriculture. But the biggest issue then goes back to exposure and access to information. Because as a young person, because even myself growing up, the person that I wanted to become and the careers that I was thinking about at the time was mainly based on people that I used to see around me, professionals that I saw around me. So in terms of farming, most young people can only dream as far as what they can see in their communities. So if they've never seen a young, successful person in their community, they've never seen somebody maybe that's doing agro-processing, value-adding tunnels or whatever, it's very difficult for them to now sit and think, oh, okay, one day I want to own tunnels, or one day I want to start my own canning company or whatever. So that then becomes important, that when you are going to be tailor-making trainings for them, expose them to various people who are the same age group as them, involved in different activities throughout agriculture. So you're able to expand their thinking and their visioning. Because even if you look at it, the way that you, when you're growing up, the person that you want to become is influenced by what you see whether it's around the community or in the movies or, you know, social media. So that's very, very important. So when they're able to see that, oh no, there's actually other opportunities in agriculture beyond primary agriculture. There's also other things that you can do and study for microbiology, horticulture, you know, all sorts of things. So it's very, very important to expose them, because then it gives them options and possibilities. And each person is then able to align the things that interest them to a particular career in agriculture. And it's not only just primary agriculture and farming on the ground.
Yeah, I know that you grew up, you're originally from Eastern Cape. And when we look at the top performing provinces in South Africa, Eastern Cape is like the least, you know. So what really made you decide to pursue a master's degree in agricultural extension as well as rural resource management in the UKZN? Because I doubt that, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I doubt that you had positive influences within the agricultural space coming from the Eastern Cape when you were young, that you could say, I want to be like this individual when I grow up. So firstly, what made you decide to pursue a degree and go right up to your master's in agricultural extension?
To be quite honest, just like you had pointed out, growing up, I did not have any examples of professional people in the agriculture sector or like commercial farmers. I grew up in a rural area, eBizana, in the Eastern Cape. And growing up, I was exposed to a lot of people in the corporate world. Mm. And, you know, I was exposed to a lot of lawyers, accountants, and just, you know, yeah, that type of career line. So in high school, I eventually ended up choosing accounting and business studies because it's what I was exposed to and it's what I started aligning my goals to. And I took agriculture as an additional subject. So when it came to applying in university, because I'd done those three subjects, I was able to pick agriculture as, you know, you always have that backup option that in case they don't take me for the other stuff, let me just. So agriculture was literally one of those. I was just like, you know, just in case. Yeah. And funny enough, the agriculture department was the first department to respond to me while I was still in high school. So my mom was like, you know what, at least they've responded. So might as well just go there. And I'm thinking, are you serious? Are you really serious? So in my mind, when I was applying, finishing matric and going to Sadara College of Agriculture, because UKZN has a partnership with Sadara. So if you do the agriculture extension and rural resource management degree, you are based at Sadara full-time for your entire undergrad degree. So when I got there, first thing I saw as driving into Sadara, I could smell silage, I saw dairy cows, and then I just saw a very long field of maize, and I was thinking to myself, wow, and I need to study for this. And I need to study, oh my goodness. So the first month I had difficulty adjusting, which then brings me back to what I just said, that the most important thing is exposure. So during my time at Sadara, we were exposed to a variety of different, activities throughout the value chain, different farmers. We met so many people who'd come to Sadara to do talks, and we'd see your, you know, MECs, HODs from agriculture. So you start thinking that, oh, okay, it's not only primary production. There are options out there. I can do this. I can do this. So that was the biggest thing for me, was exposure, which is why I always try to ensure that with projects, when I have youth members or people that have not been as exposed to agriculture, I always make it a point to try and do a few field trips with them so that they're able to see what agriculture looks like at a commercial stage. What, you know, companies that export look like. How do you actually produce seeds? You could actually start a company that, you know, produces seeds, or you can start a company that does seedling, so that they're able to see these things. Because the biggest thing is exposure. Once you're exposed to things, you're exposed to the possibilities that, you know, you could become.
Yeah, and it's true, because there are some individuals who want to partake in the agricultural sector, but not necessarily to become farmers. So I think it's very also important to start exposing individuals in terms of other business opportunities that they could take advantage of along the agricultural value chain. But I think in addition to your master's, you are currently pursuing your PhD in food security. Why food security, and why is this so important to you?
Yeah, food security is quite broad, because when you think about food security, we define it as a state in which all people at all times have both physical and economic access to sufficient food in order to meet their diet needs and for them to lead a productive and healthy life. So food security has four compartments. It's food availability, food access, utilization, and stability. And it's important because access to quality, nutritious food is fundamental for human existence. So I think that, you know, if you think about yourself as an individual, when you are living a healthy life, you're able to then do so many things. You can go to work, you know, you're able to do activities and all of these things. So if you're in a situation where you are in poverty, you're hungry, or you malnutrition, you know, all of those things, they affect your general productivity as a person. So that's why it's important to me, because now the biggest challenge is how do we produce greater quantities of food in order to feed a growing world population? Mm-hmm. How do we ensure that everyone's nutritional needs are being met, especially young children, because it affects what they're able to learn at school and what they eventually become later on in life because of their cognitive development. And also, you know, how do we ensure that the way that we produce our food minimizes the impacts to the environment and also our natural resources? And in all of that, if you think about it, that then forms what the Sustainable Development Goals, the 17 targets, what they encompass. So food security is very, very important. It forms a basis of human life in a sense. And the food system in itself is able to become a source of employment for a lot of people. You're able to, if you address food security challenges, you're able to then address poverty, and you're able to address, you know, employment opportunities and a lot of inequality. So it touches a lot of things. I can't find like a word to describe what I'm trying to say, but
it's okay.
Yeah, it encompasses a lot of things that affect human life and your development as a person.
Yeah. So what are some of the interventions that you think policymakers can do to grow the agricultural industry in South Africa and also contribute towards food security?
I think the most important thing right now is, you know, if you look at the youth unemployment rates in South Africa, we're sitting at about 59%. So it's very important now more than ever before to start designing interventions that are content specific and also that are informed by youth aspirations. It's now time for policymakers to start deliberately engaging young people in agriculture and ensuring that we're creating spaces for them to be able to transform the food system. Mm-hmm. And it's also very important for us to start building a food system that's more resilient. We've seen what's happened with in the agriculture industry with COVID-19. So more than ever before, it's now time for us to start looking at, you know, things from a food system perspective, because we're then able to see all the various activities, the inputs and the services that make up a food system, because those are the things that influence how it behaves. We're looking at, you know, the social dynamics, the political landscape, you know, the culture, technology, the economic activities, and also how we preserve the natural environment, climate change, and all of those things. So I think most importantly, policymakers need to start having, you know, and seeing things from a food systems perspective in order for us to build resilient, sustainable food systems that are able to offer a lot of employment opportunities for people. And also then we'll be able to you know, start the pathway for us to end poverty and hunger. And, you know, yeah, I don't know how to describe what I'm trying to say, but I hope you get it. So the biggest thing is just ensuring that there are support services in place, mm-hmm. and we're thinking about things in a system perspective so that we're able to minimize threats and vulnerabilities and ensure that the system that we're building is able to last and endure anything that could possibly happen. And yeah. It's also quite important for policymakers to also look at how they can create spaces for private sector investment so that not everything related to agriculture comes from the department, but what can other stakeholders and different people from the private sector do in order for us to work towards a common goal?
Yeah. So what advice would you give to a young person listening to this podcast, especially someone that has studied a degree in agriculture or is currently pursuing a qualification in agriculture? And the reason why I ask this, Wendy, is because I receive a number of emails from young agricultural graduates looking for employment opportunities at the farm. And it typically seems like, you know, they're all seeking for one thing, but not broadening their horizon in terms of other opportunities that they could pursue in agriculture. And the reason, the number one thing that I get, and I know a number of farmers also get, is requests for in-service training. I understand that that's very mandatory to do as so that you could get your degree or pass your qualification. However, what advice would you give to a young agricultural graduate listening to this podcast, wanting to pursue a career in farming, in agriculture, clear along the value chain? That is right now sitting at home with a degree and doesn't know where to go.
I think the most important thing is to try and look at your surroundings and what's happening around you. And then also think about how can you best position yourself to ensure that you, if you want to be in primary production, look at the farmers around you. Can you actually go and learn from them? Or can you, because it's not very easy. A lot of people don't understand that it's not easy to just start a farming operation, especially if you have a degree, you just came out of school, you have no access to funding. And in order to get funding, you must prove that you will be able to use the money for what you want it for. So I think it's just a matter of not limiting your options. Look at your surroundings around you, look at what other people are doing, especially the things that you're most interested in, and try and position yourself so that they are also able to either employ you or to transfer skills to you. And it's important for you not to think in a box. Like if you studied agriculture, you can then be an advisor, or you can, you know, there's so many things that you can do in agriculture. Just do research on the different career options that are out there and not only limit yourself to what you've studied. I studied agriculture extension, but sometimes I work as a research assistant, and you know, sometimes I'm an advisor, sometimes I'm, you know, I'm doing so many things. It's not only limited to what I studied. So it's very important for us not to limit ourselves in terms of what we studied and what we think we want to work in, you know, because some of the employment opportunities that have came to me, it's things that I never thought about before, but it's because I was just trying everything at the time that was working, and you eventually then start finding your path. So it's quite important to constantly think outside the box of how can I position myself in order for me to be able to be attractive to somebody who is, you know, looking to hire out people. Or if you want to become an entrepreneur, what's the best strategy for you right now based on the resources that you have available to you? And, you know, the knowledge that you have. So I think it's very important to just think outside the box, position yourself in a way that other people also want to work with you and other people also want to be a part of what you're doing.
Yeah.
And social media has been quite a very important platform in that sense, because we see more people than ever before now starting to post about their farming activities. So other people who were not aware that there were young farmers in those areas are now able to see them, and they're able to know what the farmers are doing. And whenever there's a project or something that's happening, they then call the closest farmers to them. So social media is also very, very, a very important tool.
Yeah, no, thanks for that. What is your goal for your career, and where do you see yourself in the next 3 to 5 years?
Well, yeah, that's a very interesting question. I think that, you know, when I look back to when I was probably 20, what I had imagined I'd become and what I thought, you know, I'd be at this age, it came to me in a way that I never imagined. And that was mainly because I have tried as much as possible not to box myself, you know, in one aspect of agriculture. It's good to specialize, but sometimes, you know, it's also good to spread your wings. So when I think about my career in the next 3 to 5 years, the biggest thing right now is for me to graduate with my PhD And in whatever capacity I will be serving at or working in, I still want to work in the rural development and capacity building space, particularly in rural areas. And I'd also like to work in the policy formulation space or advisory space at regional level. And, you know, the biggest thing that interests me right now is more around promoting sustainable, healthy food systems and building resilience in rural communities, either at national, regional, global levels. So wherever, you know, my energy takes me, as as long as I'm working within those spaces, I don't have anything specific that's set, because, you know, when I look at myself and how far I've come, it's different from what I thought I'd be doing right now, but it seems to be working. So I'm just going to let it keep doing that as long as it's within those spaces.
Well, I think you're doing amazing work already.
Thank you so much.
Not only being on the ground, but having such a defined and clear vision of how and where you want to position yourself in the agricultural sector. So it's nice to finally speak to a young person who's very certain about the part that they would like to play in agriculture. So it's quite refreshing. And I wish you all the best with your studies.
Oh, thank you.
And most importantly, with your research topic. I've never reached to my PhD level, but I can imagine that it's quite time consuming, and especially having to work with communities on the ground as well that really rely on you for support in many different aspects. So congratulations. And I really want to commend you for the work that you're doing on the ground, especially supporting rural communities, because not many people will choose to maybe pursue that part in agriculture. And I know supporting people comes with a lot of patience and understanding.
You teach so much about yourself.
Pardon?
No, I'm saying you get to learn so much about yourself through working with other people, especially when these conflicts and different situations are happening in the community. It really makes you learn more about the kind of person that you are. And, you know, some days are better than others. And some days you realize that, no, listen, this has nothing to do with me. It's a community issue. It's got nothing to do with me. So it's been very insightful.
Well, I'm glad that you've definitely picked up some certain personal characteristics or traits. But yeah, all the best with your studies. And I really, really mean that. And thank you for having this conversation with me.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
It's a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to this episode. Your feedback is always important. Therefore, please rate and review this podcast. You can follow me on social media at Mbali Nwoko on Instagram, LinkedIn, Twitter, as well as YouTube. Should you wish to contact me directly, kindly send me an email at info@mbalinwoko.com. Look out for next week's episode. Until then, take care.